Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In the summer before the new millennium, I moved from central London to a house in the west of Ireland, less than a mile from where my father had been reared. The title deeds gave my address as Mona Keeper East. Mona, I could work out because of Borden Mona. The Keeper bit was a mystery, until Michael Joe Tarpey, who'd been to school with my father, explained that Keebs were the hard, rooty bits that you found in some turf, such as that from the Barakta bog behind my house. And it seemed that I had Turbary rights there, a valuable source of fuel. It was time to educate myself. Two cousins led me to this bog, bordering onto the Shannon, and as we left the stony road and stepped onto the bogland path, it was like walking on a trampoline. We bounced along, and when I looked back at where we'd trodden, I saw that under our weight the black earth had sent up a creamy foam that filled our footprints just like the head on a pint of stout. It was a strange landscape, flat, with no trees, just a few scrubby bushes, and a host of what looked like lolly sticks with white pennants at the top, shivering in the breeze. Bog cotton. I'd never been anywhere as peaceful. The only sound, the river, lapping at the shores of Lough Derg. The city woman in me wondered at the lack of fences. How could you tell where your strip of bog stopped and someone else's started? Cousin Tom told me everyone just knew, and Cousin Pat helpfully tied a plastic bag to a bush to identify where my strip began. My learning curve was steep. In a romantic fit, when I first arrived, I'd bought some old implements from a farmer, delighted to get rid of them. Scythes and hay forks and two turf barrows, plus a spade with one sharp edge that I was told was a slane for cutting turf. A museum piece, as there's scarcely a sinner left cutting in the old way. Digging out waterlogged sods of turf and throwing them up onto the bank is heavy work, and when the turf-cutting machine came along, everyone embraced it. That summer of 1999, I watched a juggernaut trundle down the road beyond my field and was advised to tell its owner how many hoppers of turf I wanted cut. What was a hopper? I was never entirely clear on this, but I went down to look. Moving on caterpillar treads and making an incessant rattle, the machine extruded the cut turf behind it like black toothpaste being squeezed out of giant tubes. After a couple of days, when a crust had formed on the top of the sod, I was told to straddle a row and turn the lower, wet side up to the sun and the wind. Some machines cut six sods across the row, others eight, and eight is quite enough, believe me. Hour upon hour, I was bent double, with my neck at a desperate angle. But as Cousin Pat told me, the only way is arse in the air and stay going. At the end of my first day, I was walking like a very saddle-sore John Wayne. One year it never stopped raining, and my only hope was to get the sods up from the wet ground onto wooden pallets. It was like lifting slices of soggy chocolate cake between your fingers. More crumbled away than landed on the pallet, and that season was a write-off. As everyone who tends a bog knows, turning is but the first step in the long, labour-intensive process that must be undertaken before you can settle in for the winter with enough sods to light a sweet-smelling fire and bake a cake of bread. A few years ago, the EU became alarmed at the disappearance of bogs across Europe and allocated money to compensate those who stopped cutting certain designated bogs. Some people round here got hot under the collar, being told they couldn't cut turf from the very bog their fathers and grandfathers had. So, to deter any hotheads, a squad car with two Gardaí was parked up the entire summer, blocking the road to my bog. Towards the end of August, a few protesters gathered in a huddle on the main road, their hand-painted placards swearing defiance. As the squad car departed for good, a mighty cheer went up, but it was a Pyrrhic victory. I have sympathy with those who feel their birthright is being taken from them, but I'm glad to cut no longer. While we humans are hell-bent on sending greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, this ancient bog, like wetlands all over the world, is absorbing and storing carbon dioxide and doing its bit to counteract climate crisis. Nowadays, when I walk along that springy path, I bless the bog and feel I'm now a true Mauna Kea woman.
Neither con the suckers can take me. Oh, hey, hey. Gonna mock the joint and borrow a gun, cause son of my haven.
The Old Bog Road. Immortalised in memories and song, anywhere Irish people gather. But have you heard of the oldest bog road? How old, you ask? Would 148 BC impress you? Then come with me to the wilds of Longford, to the Corlee Bog Road. Over 2,000 years old, it's what is called a toher, an Iron Age roadway, the largest of its kind to be excavated in Europe. When the road was discovered in 1984 during peat harvesting, radiocarbon dating placed it in the Iron Age. It was dendrochronology, dating wood by the tree rings within it, that allowed for more accuracy, revealing that the timber used in the road was felled in 148 or 147 BC. It took around 300 large oak trees to build the road, which ran for 2 kilometres. It was constructed from split planks laid on top of raised birch rails, making it suitable for carts and other wheeled transport. The oak planks were heavy, too heavy as it turned out, and only a few years after it was built, the Corlee Road sank into the bog, lost but perfectly preserved for over 2,000 years. It's thought that it was part of a ceremonial highway connecting the Hill of Uisneach in Westmeath with Rathcrohan in Roscommon. The Hill of Uisneach was where the Bealtaine fire was lit and the High Kings crowned, while Rathcrohan was a royal site and legend has it once home of the warrior Queen Maeve, ruler of all Connacht. Now it's a road to nowhere, an early monument to shoddy construction work and bad planning. But, to be fair to those Iron Age builders, it's thought that the road only took a year to construct. An impressive timeline, in today's terms. The road is now housed in its own museum at Corlee. Entering a quiet, custom-built hall, you can peer down at an impressive 18-metre stretch of the road. It looks like driftwood, though it has never seen the sea. Wooden stakes still hold the planks in place. Standing in the silent museum, looking down at the time-worn wood, can you hear faint whispers, as light as bog cotton on the breeze? Did the road builders argue as it sank? Some thinking it looked as good as the day it was built, and others suspecting that all was not right with their impressive new road. An uneven plank here, an encroachment of bog there, the carts beginning to have trouble moving over it. Give it some welly, it just needs a bit of strength behind it. The ceremonial robes getting dirty from all the peat being thrown up, the royals unhappy with the bumpy ride. Eventually, They proclaim that the horses may as well be wading through the bog for all the good the road is doing. Accusations against the builders. I thought you said you were a master craftsman. How the hell are we going to get the great and the good from Ishnach to Rathcrohan on this sinking disaster? It'll be grand. Grand. You step over there to Rathcrohan now and tell that to Queen Maeve. Let me know how you get on. It's my head she'll be chopping off when this goes wrong. A dragonfly could land on that thing and sink it at this rate. Well, if you wanted a road builder, you should have sent off to Rome. Them lads now. I hear they can build a road. The whispers fade. A door creaks. The tour guide strides in and begins to hold forth to a group of awed tourists with another, more romantic theory about this road. It can be found in the old story of the wooing of Etain from the Irish mythological cycle, Tales of an Ancient Race of Gods, the Tuatha De Danann. Etain, a beautiful mortal woman, was married to the High King of Ireland, but Midir from the Tuatha De Danann also loved her. Midir challenged the king to play Fihil, an ancient Irish board game, with him. They placed larger and larger bets on their game until the king challenged Midir to build a road across a bog. Was this the Corley Bog Road, built to win the love of a beautiful woman? Midir raised the stakes again and suggested that they play to win an embrace from Etain. Midir won, and when he clasped Etain in his arms, the lovers turned into swans, flapped their wings and flew away. A better way to travel, perhaps, than the ill-fated Corley Bog Road.
What do you call a sod of turf in French? How do you describe its texture, its weight, how rough it is when it's dry? Even now I can feel it, harsh against the skin of my hand. You could say it's like a brick, and it lights a fire, a bit like coal. But it's not really. And how do you translate the word bog? It's a tough one to explain to someone who's never seen it. I remember trying to. Nearly 20 years ago in Brussels. I had just moved to Belgium. Surrounded by European flatmates from Spain, France and Italy, I attempted a description of how we heated our houses back home. A futile exercise. Because to describe the bog is not just to convey a sense of the physical lump of turf in front of you. It is to describe a civilization. Perhaps like olive farming in Spain, or the vineyards of France. It takes in everything around it. The bog is a way of life, a whole culture to be understood. Not just the traditional harvest in August, but its perpetual dependence on the weather and the everyday routine of lighting a fire. It permeates everything within its grasp. How could you get that across to Europeans from dry, hot summer climes with ne'er a bag of peat in sight? Abroad, people often ask me where I'm from. I usually mention Tullamore Dhu. But when I'm back home, I also observe that this Midlands bog county could also be called Ireland's Rust Belt. Unaffected by tourism, impervious to visitors, stagnant. A once lucrative and vibrant industry is now gone. Preserving the bogs has absurdly meant emptying them of anyone to notice them. And what does the bog mean to me? Well, it means no reception on the train on the way to Athlone. It means I have the flat accent of the Midlands. It means hearing Luca Bloom's I'm a Bog Man on Spotify and feeling a small bit of home. But it also means memories. Because the bog has influenced me in myriad ways, punctuating my youth in an understated but continuous manner. Bringing in the turf for my mother, weighed down with one bucket on each side. A chore I did not always stick with. Being shown how to light a fire in the old solid fuel range, which had pride of place in every Irish household and heated the entire house. Throw the turf in the back, never the front. It'll smoke that way. Sweeping up the turf from around the grate or taking out the ashes. Turf was in the everyday. It never stopped. Being brought out on the bog one summer to help foot turf. Done differently everywhere, but in our case, stacking it two by two about 5 rows high. Just enough that a child could manage it, so it could dry out. It also meant getting sunburned in the summer sun. I was home recently. I found a picture of myself sitting atop a recently delivered load of turf. I might have been 10 or 12. It was out in the backyard, beside the turf shed. I had volunteered to throw the whole lot in, but had become fatigued early on in the task, and was now posing languidly for a picture. The original burnout. There are memories too of my poor unwitting Swedish cousins being introduced to the marshy landscapes of their ancestors by way of the terminally slow bog train at Clonmacnoise. Hardly a scintillating tourist attraction, but one they claim to have enjoyed. Simpler times. I'm drawn to the bog now. Before I moved to Iceland 2 years ago, I drove around Offaly's bogs, out through Rahan, past Pulla, to some of the quietest parts of Ireland. I went to another bog this year in Galway and saw a farmer footing his turf against a backdrop of wind turbines, the old and the new juxtaposed. I got out to speak to him and picked up a sod of turf, not fully dry yet, still with the heaviness of recent rain. Rows of turf neatly arranged. The bog is there in all the things you notice when you come home. A turf fire during Storm Éowyn, a godsend when electricity and heat pumps failed. Passing the iconic chimneys of Lanesborough's peat-fired power station, en route to my father's hometown of Strokestown for a visit. And the smell of smoke wafting from the chimney of a small cottage on Tullamore's Kilbride Street, on a day when the air is damp and there's no wind. I get the scent of the old days, wistful and nostalgic. Now I live somewhere more similar to Ireland. Not one of Europe's warmer countries, but an island more remote than Ireland. In its centre it has lava fields, not sods of turf. Equally untranslatable once you've seen one. But I still think of where I come from. And maybe I won't stay away too much longer. But until then, I have this picture of young me and a load of turf, and every memory that it evokes. Home.
So many people look at the bog as a place that just lies dead. Nothing to do for the body, nothing to do for the head. Take me where the heather and the moss grows, the turf lies row after row.
Growing up in West Roscommon, we were never far from the bog. When I looked out my window in the morning, the predominant colour was the purple of the heather, accentuated by the yellow gorse in spring and summer. But what I took for granted was amazing to my cousin from the city streets of Manchester. On her first visit to Ireland in the 70s, she stared at the flat bogs stretching miles ahead of us. "Oh my Lord," she said, "there's so much space." She and her sister arrived in mid-August and giggled when I announced that we would visit the bog, collapsing in mirth every time I mentioned it. That's when I discovered that in Manchester and elsewhere, bog is slang for toilet. My cousins enthusiastically provided much-needed help at farming tasks. I looked on in wonderment as they pitched in at turning turf, a job I hated. I let them at it, lighting a small campfire. We sat around the fire while the old black kettle bubbled and took out our sandwiches. I had never seen tinned meats, and to this day I can remember the taste and the texture of the Fraybentus corned beef that our visitors had brought over. We enjoyed our picnic, serenaded by the haunting call of a curlew pack, doubtless upset by the tang of smoke in the clear air. But a frog who rambled into the picnic caused a major diplomatic incident, as the two girls screamed and clung to each other. I looked from the startled frog to them with wonder. What could they be so afraid of? The turf we were rising and footing into heaps to dry had been hand-cut with a sleighan, a type of spade with a wing. The sods were dug out by my father and slung out to be caught in mid-air by one of us and placed on a homemade wooden barrow. They were then wheeled out from the bog hole and spread to dry in the summer sun. After a period, they were then turned and rose off the ground to allow the sun and wind to dry them. The final part of the turf's journey came when our donkey, named Leatherlugs, drew it home in a homemade cart. It would be stored in a reek and thatched with rushes cut from the field nearby. All this hard work was essential, we all knew, to provide us with heat during the long, hard winters. Inside our farmhouse, our cousin sat in wonderment on cool summer evenings as the flames roared up the chimney. They had gas heating in the city, and their amazement knew no bounds when my mother produced a cast iron oven and proceeded to bake homemade bread over the open fire. They sat quietly in the country kitchen as the churn cranked and golden butter was produced. My father explained that in ancient times the butter was buried in the bog to preserve it. They looked at me with a question in their wide eyes. He is joking, isn't he? One day we hiked across that flat bog to a little lake where I showed them how to set a worm on a cork float. We watched, hardly breathing, as the perch nibbled and the cork bobbed up and down before slowly drawing away. As I landed the colourful perch, two pairs of eyes regarded me with awe and wonder. For once I was sure of my role in territory, a good feeling for a young fellow who was becoming increasingly conscious of his less than trendy farming clothes. When the holiday was over and our summer visitors were packing for the journey back home in the gleaming Austin Cambridge, one of the girls came to me with a special request. Could she bring a sod of turf home with her to show her friends back in the city and to keep as a souvenir of that holiday? So that summer day, the three of us set off again, singing Mungo Jerry's in the summertime, and the girls paid one last visit to a special place they hadn't known existed a fortnight ago, the bog.
For the last 2 years, I have been spending some days out of my city and down in the bogs of the Midlands. This time it's been spent there, sometimes literally, with the peatland squelching or baking under my boots, or else back at my desk in Dublin, still in the bog, albeit in my memory and mind. Being an architect, as I am, means that you get to spend a lot of time in your own head. There are two key things you need as an architect: imagination and optimism. Because when you design things to be built and to be used, you have to imagine and hope the world will be a better place for your efforts. From the first sketch of an idea for a room layout, to the happy sound of a key turning in the lock of someone's new home, you hope that life for the people who visit or use what you design will improve as a result. They might be warmer, happier, healthier, more inclined to stop and say hello to their neighbour. They may even be encouraged by the way their front doors are designed to be next to each other, to gradually linger a bit longer and chat, form a neighbourhood, gather on a sunny summer evening in a shared outdoor space to tell their stories under a canopy of trees, planted in just the right spot after hours and hours of design studies. Design is about making our everyday lives not just better, but brilliant. But while you spend time alone in your head as an architect, you do not actually, in truth, work or build all by yourself. These last years, I have been working with many others. Bernadine, Vanessa, Dean, Felix, Sarah, Frank, and Evelyn and David. The latter pair also architects, who together are called 12th Field. That pair have been the designers of a bright yellow timber structure, the Bog Body. The reason we have all been down in the bogs, in fact. This is the first structure of what we are calling a new peatlands architecture, a project which in many ways wants, by and through collective design, to make life better. You may already be wondering why we are building on the bog, such a seemingly precious and fragile landscape. But the truth is, in Ireland, we have long since built on the bog. Just look to the incredible metal factories once built to harvest and hold turf. Find the quirky, intimate tea sheds for workers' breaks and sausage fry-ups. Search for the films and photographs of what was Europe's largest industrial railway, used to mobilise men and material. In this, you have ample evidence that design ingenuity and pragmatic building instinct and intelligence have for decades and across generations been put to good use in what is a working landscape, once at the heart and hearth of thousands of workers and families. Even today, when you visit some bogs, the huts, tracks and the many empty factories of Bordnamona remain as physical traces of a built bog. We are not yet sure what to do with these buildings and material fragments of our past, our heritage and identity, and many are sadly falling apart or are being taken away. But while they remain, these buildings, structures, tracks and more can be read like an archive of once local labour and national ambition, like a diary of the life of a whole island which literally turned itself on each evening with the electricity generated from huge fires fuelled by turf. Shane Heinen, an artist, a photographer, has been working in the space of the bogs for some time now, gathering stories with his eyes through his own unique lens. He is interested in the now of the bog, what we do with and about it today, understanding this deeply through the stories of the communities he works with. Of the many astonishing photographs he has taken, there is one that remains in my mind, taken as part of the Bog Body project. It is of a beige empty room once occupied by workers. In the middle of the frame hangs a thick brown check shirt on a hook, fixed to a wall. There are some papers left on a desk beside, not tidied, not messy either. It is almost as if the man who might wear that shirt on a cold day has stepped out of the room for just a moment, when in truth, he left this place and the shirt and the life it was part of behind some time ago. It is the most moving of photographs. Of course, it is a reminder of an industry and a way of life we now know to be over, because such a life is not economically or climatically sustainable now. But there is no nostalgia in that photograph for me. Just the truth that all we can ever do to change the world we live in is to act in the moment. When I look at this photograph, I know that there is no point in getting stuck romanticising the past or wasting time idly dreaming about some fantastic future. I am reminded that in architecture you have to act right now, with the people around you, working together, listening to each other's stories for the past for sure, giving time to the worries and ideas about what next for the places in which we live and love. And the bogs are no different. The yellow Bog Body is now part of a bog building tradition, one that was always responsive to the needs of the time, national economic priorities and the real lives of Peatlands communities. Times change though, and we cannot know what the future holds for these landscapes, not fully, not yet. But right now, the Bothy is this yellow architectural anchor around which communities of people appear to be gathering, offering room for their imaginations and optimism to take flight, where the stories of this boggy earth now fuel the fires of their creative ideas, the hopes and desires of a nation's shared future, no longer governed above in Dublin, but instead alight and alive in every single one of them.
Thank you. Bog casket. Squelch, gurgle, drip, suck, sink, swallow. The slow creep of wet mosses, lime green, raspberry red, saffron yellow, swallowing up pools, ferns, rushy grasses, fallen trees, tree roots, and deer with giant antlers. Blanket bog, raised bog, active bog, acid bog, stealthily creeping over fields and walls, over rings of stone where timber houses once lifted their skirts out of the dampness, over trackways, old bog roads sinking slowly under their own weight. All the things the bog has taken in its maw, squeezing out the life juices, draining away the colours. Things lost and given, and then found over the centuries by farmers, turf cutters, railway builders, archaeologists, a Pandora's box of things on show for us in the National Museum of Ireland. Shields of leather, huge wooden cartwheels, fish traps, sharp timber spikes set to break the flight of leaping deer, bronze cauldrons, leather water canteens, their ornate mouthpieces made for important mouths, great lumps of butter wrapped in leaves or wicker or spooned into wooden vessels and then buried in the cool, dark larder of the bog. A set of writing tablets made from yew wood, still waxed after 1,000 years. And in 2006, miraculously, a book of Psalms, the calfskin pages falling open on the phrase, in Valle Lacrimarum, in the Valley of Tears. Personal possessions outliving their owners, a shoe made from the softest leather, gathered at the instep, delicate as a dancer's pump. Who could have been wearing such finery on a bog? And what aristocratic foot wore the leather slip-on, ribbon-punched and carved with oak leaves, made for a prince of the church, perhaps? And the boot that looks like it belonged to a fairy-tale woodcutter. 100 tiny tacks fastening the wooden clog to a thick leather upper. The wearer may be pulled from a bog hole, the loss of a boot a small price to pay for being saved. But no chance at all of getting out of a bog pool in the shin-roan skirt. 23 pieces of heavy wool cloth sewn together, 7 yards wide at the hem. Fine for a Dutch still life, but lethal for an Offaly bog. And the bodies. People deliberately killed, deliberately buried, nameless, but familiar to us from photos and poems. Their squashed faces, inscrutable, but not howling like naked skulls. Murdered and placed in borderland. Sacrificed, punished, disappeared. A 4,000-year-old tradition lingering on and on. The dead telling us more about the living than about their own short lives. Bodies of young men, mostly. But unusually, in 2023, the body of a young woman found in a bog close to the home place of Seamus Heaney. She'd been decapitated 2,000 years ago. Ballaghy now added to the old man-killing parishes Heaney wrote about in his bog poems. Accidental deaths, too. People who slipped down the open throat of the bog. Mothers and infants. Lost peddlers. Lone travellers. Among them, the man found in a Sligo bog in 1824. His body so fresh an inquest was called for. He was wearing a full suit of clothes, a woollen frock coat with 35 cloth buttons to keep out the cold, check leggings, a cloak, shoes, a sheepskin hat, all well made but 200 years out of date. In his hand, all that time, a leather bag with a single coin and a ball of yarn. Bogland, place of mists and sudden fairy winds, big skies, black rain, liminal space liked by hares and frogs, and snipe, the bog bleater, and Jesus spiders that walk on water, and sundew and butterworth plants enticing their insect victims with sugary snacks. Nighttime brings the shapeshifters, Will-o'-the-Wisp, Liam na Lasoiga, a big badger seen shaving himself by the light of the moon in a Mayo bog. In Westmeath, at first light, a crowing cock turns into a white horse. But different in daytime. A day on the bog, oh, the emigrant longing for it. The manosphere of Schlan, sods, ricks, banks, donkeys, creels, and tea brewed in blackened kettles. I'll settle down forever on the bogs of Shanna Heaver. But so many of Ireland's bogs gone now. Hardly a curlew left to mourn them. Red bog, bog of the beautiful trees, bog of the cats, bog of the yellow fence, bog of the trackway, bog of the lake of the king's evil, bog of the ring, featherbed bog.
On this morning's Sunday Miscellany, part one of Writing the Bog, scripts in response to the Irish Architecture Foundation's Bog Bothy project, we heard Mona Keeba Meditation by Margaret Hickey, The Old Bog Road by Niamh Donlan, An Emigrant Bog Dweller by Karen McHugh, The Bog by Anthony Baggett. The Bog Bothy was by Emmett Scanlon, and Bog Casket by Claire Cotter. The music was Toge Gaboge by Keela, performed by the Lazy Band, King of the Fairies by Horselips, I'm a Bogman by Luca Bloom, In the Summertime by Mungo Jerry, and Butterfly by the Bothy Band. To find out more about the Irish Architecture Foundation's Bog Bothy project, see architecturefoundation.ie. And we will bring you part two of Sunday Miscellany, Writing the Bog, in our programme on Sunday, the 26th of October. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from Sunday Miscellany, go to the RTE radio app, the programme website, or all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.